Welcome to the Monday Night Speaker Series at Woodbridge here. Please welcome our speaker for tonight, Jill, who's going to share her Strength Open experience.
My name is Jill. I'm a compulsive overeater.
Hi, Jill.
Hi. I was born into a family of compulsive overeaters. Everybody was severely obese other than my brother, who always was a normal weight, and he was adopted. But he ended up not having the problem we had. So I was born into a family that used food. My parents were severely obese, and I always used food. I just always did, from the earliest time. I can't even say I remember being able to say that it was because of fear, because of any kind of emotion. I just always used food for everything from the youngest age. So childhood wasn't an easy thing going through school. I always looked different. I was always the biggest kid in the class. I was always the tallest kid in the class, the fattest kid in the class, the ugliest kid in the class. So, you know, growing up, it's very, very difficult to live with that level of rejection for that many years from that young of an age. I went into high school, and you know, it got worse. It got worse and worse and worse in high school because some friends went to one high school. I went to another, and my eating habits got worse and worse. When I was about 10, my mom went back to work, so I was home alone in the afternoon. I do remember it taking a serious downturn then because I had just too much freedom. After high school, I went on an extreme diet, and I lost all my weight before college. At that time, all my weight was about, I guess, 90 pounds that I needed to lose. So I went into college a fairly normal weight, but I had no recovery. I mean, I was even purging for that little bit of time. I would never classify myself as a bulimic, but for that period of time, I was to keep my weight down. I had nothing. I was still using food, even though I was a normal weight. I got married in the middle of college, so I was 20 years old when I got married. And my husband was in the military. Well, he was just going into the military. So we went out, the day after our wedding, we went out to Minot, North Dakota. So that was actually 20 years ago, last month. And so when I went out there, of course, then I had no friends, I had no family. My husband was gone about half of the time. He was he worked in security, so he was always out by the missiles. So I gained all the weight back and more and tons more by the time. I mean, I went up to almost 300 pounds within a few years. And so I just lived a life of a cycle of, you know, eating and depression and anxiety and not knowing how to cope and not, you know, a life unlived, really. It was a life unlived. I went to college and I did all those things. I even got my graduate degree and stuff like that. But outside of those confines, it was just a life unlived. I didn't live a reality, you know. I kept myself insulated and with food. And so it was, we were traveling around in the military, so I didn't have, you know, your support system was always shifting and changing. Finally, I came into program, I guess it'll be 12 years in March, I gained my abstinence, and I came to program because I finally hit a bottom. For me, my bottom was, after 10 years of marriage, my body wouldn't get pregnant, you know, I guess it was 9 years at that time. So my body just wouldn't get pregnant, not at that weight. There's just too many problems. And, you know, we're ready. I know my husband wanted children by then. You know, we had really, when we traveled around the world, you know, it was always easy to say, oh, you know, we'll just put off children, no big deal. You know, we were in Europe and everything else. You know, it really came down to that point. We were, you know, he wanted children. And, you know, that was my bottom. That was my bottom, not being able to give my husband children. And so I found a meeting. At that first meeting, I found the person that I wanted to be my sponsor, and she talked to me, and she's amazing. We still have an amazing relationship to this day. And I remember talking, I think that was a Wednesday, and on Thursday we talked about my food plan. Friday, it was March 1st, it was going to be my first day. And I remember Thursday going through the commissary and shopping for all of my new abstinent foods. And I put in my cart figuring I was going to have my Last Supper, because that was how I always lived my diet life. I was going to have my Last Supper before I started. So I put in my favorite binge food. It happened to be a long, slim package. And what was so funny, I walked around the perimeter of the commissary over and over contemplating. There was something in me that just knew, if nothing changes, nothing changes. And I fought it by walking around that store. And at one point, I've been shopping for a lot of years. That was the only time anything ever came out of my cart. The darn, it slipped out of my cart and onto the floor. I kid you not. The only time that ever happened. And finally, I tell you, I was at the point of just tears in my breaking point. The moment of my abstinence, the reason I have my abstinence today, I believe, is because I picked up that box and I was willing to do it differently at that moment. It wasn't the next morning that did it. It was that night. That was really the wall of futility. For me, step one, that powerlessness, is about hitting the wall of futility. And I hit it that night. I hit it. I was willing to put it back. It wasn't the day the food plan started. It wasn't the day then. That was my moment. And it was the time that I realized that it's just not, you know, it's on a gut level. It's just not up here anymore then when I'm ready to do it. It's just not here anymore. And my struggle and program is to get it out of here and down back in that gut. I had it that night. It went to my gut. I knew. So I put it back. It was just, it was a death. It was a death. It was a necessary death, but a part of me died, a kind of an ego part of me. It died. It needed to die, but it was a death. I mean, people can't understand this, that you don't go through it, but it was a death of me, and so that night was so painful. I mean, how do you explain to anybody how painful it is of putting a box of food back on a shelf and not eating it? You know what I'm saying? You freely did it. But it was a night of pain because I knew I died a part of me. So, for my step one, that's where it began. It's a wall of futility. Ultimately, you know, I came to a point that I realized, and that, you know, the growth happens when the tears come for me, when I realize I'm at the end of the road. And, you know, step one, yeah, I'm telling you about it for the food, but step one for any problem in my life, it's when I get to the point of futility, that there's nothing more I can do. And that brings tears. It really doesn't bring anger. It just brings pain. It's just sad. And so every problem in my life, I almost know when I'm getting somewhere, when I feel that feeling in my gut, that feeling that I can't do this, that feeling of I'm done, and the sadness and the tears can come and I mourn it, that's when I know that I'm actually going to get somewhere. So today I do see... to get to step one, it's very nice when I can see my own problem and I can see my futility. Okay, I've reached it. I get that. But I often need a good whopping kick in the butt. It's just what I need sometimes. I need a crisis to make defects surface that I can live with on a regular basis. I need a crisis sometimes. It's just, and I got a good one about 18 months ago, a really whopping one. And it kicked me from one side of my life to the other. And in that crisis, my defects started to come up. The weakness in my relationship with God came up. And all the things that ultimately could lead to my tears and then doing something about it. But before then, I could cruise with them there. I couldn't see them. I couldn't see them until they were until I crashed. So step one, again, is my wall of futility. It's my tears. It's my power. It's the sadness. It's where the surrender begins. And I guess what I kind of want to do tonight is just kind of walk through how I'm using the steps in my life today. For me, step two. I used to think of step three as the crux of my program. This is really where it all came. This is where... you know, the rubber hit the road. Was I going to give my life to my higher power? Today, it's in step two. Because step three doesn't really doesn't work until I really come to believe that there's a power greater than myself, that I trust that there's that power. And that sounds so easy up here. It's just so easy to go here, step three. But why can't I give this over? Why does this stuff keep going over and over in my head? That's my sure sign I'm not in surrender. I'm manipulating it. I'm trying to figure it out. I'm coming up with solutions, you know, all in the name of being mature and logic and problem solving. I've got it all going up here. That's my sure sign that I'm not in surrender, because surrender is a peaceful place and the answers come and all of a sudden the people walk into my life and the phone calls happen and, you know, a little bit of research yields big things and all of a sudden I'm just led places. So I find myself in my head and I know I'm not in surrender. And why? Well, let me go back. You know, if I look at my day, I set my alarm. I trust that my alarm clock's going to go off. I don't fret about that. I trust a little piece of machinery that plugs into the wall, and I'm fine. I trust that my husband's going to get up and do certain things so I can go on my walk in the morning. I trust him. I don't fret. I don't go over in my mind all night, is he going to get up and make the eggs? Are the kids going to be dressed when I come home? Are they going to be ready for school? Is this that? I don't fret about these things, because I have a level of trust in who's taking care of it. I trust the alarm clock more than God. Really? I don't worry that the alarm clock, could it go wrong? Yeah, but you know what? I have such a level of trust. So I find step two is really where I'm at right now, in coming to believe in more than my head. And step 11 is the tie-in here. That's where it comes from. Is God bigger than what I'm going through? Can I peacefully surrender? Or is it all up here and am I manipulating it? So when I work step two, I mean, I don't know if you ever had that beloved teacher in school. You would have done anything they asked for, absolutely anything. That's like the God river that flows through me, totally trustworthy. We should just throw myself down into that river. Well, step three is easy when I'm throwing myself, when I believe the river's flowing. Step three is maybe not, I don't know if I can say easy. There is an ease to it when I believe and I trust. It's not, I can't say it's easy in that I want to do what I'm doing, but then there's an ease because the decision's made, because I know. I just know and I trust. So right now, I'm working very hard on step two because it's for me the new crux of my program for today. And next year, I'll tell you, maybe it's something else. For now, it's step two. So I'm looking to trust that river of love that runs through me, to which I'm connected. It's that separation that I believe is my basic problem. Because submitting to perfect love and guidance is easy when I feel it, the presence is there. It's like that wonderful, I remember Sister Frances in first grade. I would have done anything for Sister Frances. She was the most delightful, delightful person, and she was so sweet and kind to a little girl who was just, I ostracized myself. I remember even talking to a friend about this, and she said, Jill, she said, I don't really remember you being made fun of all that much. I said, you know, I don't really remember it either. I really don't claim to be, but I remember the persecution in my head continually, constantly. It was so much more effective and harmful than anything anybody. They could never have had the constancy that I provided myself for persecution. They never could have. So I did it all myself. And so, you know, this is what went through me, and I lost myself there for a minute. Oh, so Sister Frances is there giving me love. Wow, I saw God in Sister Frances. I felt that I would have done anything for her. So my life right now is about getting that feeling that I want to do anything for God, that He is this perfect river, that is just, if I just go with it. But you know, before I can go into that perfect river of love, see, like when I put that food back, I've got to jump off a cliff of death. I've got to die. Part of me's got to die before I can get to that river. That's what it feels like to me. It just feels like a death before I can go into that glorious river. That's not easy. I'm not saying it's easy, but I'm just saying I have a willingness that takes all the garbage out of my head. You know, I can get on a one track there. So, as far as keeping my sense of presence right now, there is a lot of things that I'm trying to do that I'm working on. One of the things There's another, we talk about Dear Frances in this 12 and 12 book. There was another lady that, I don't know if she was his contemporary, but another saint. But she talks about being like a worm. And I love that because I can really, when I get in touch with myself as little, I can feel how big God is. In fact, one of my favorite meditations I got out of a book was imagining myself in my house and then picturing myself then in my house on my street and then in my town. And everything starts getting bigger and bigger around me, and I can feel this internal shift where my problems become smaller and smaller and smaller because I get perspective. I gain perspective. So I love thinking of myself as a precious little worm. And I've said this before, a lovely hat, you know, just, you know, pretty sunglasses, you know, a precious little worm, but a worm. That's because I don't have more power than that. That's really all I walk around life with. And this helps me in my coming to believe that a pen of power greater than myself. If I look at my smallness, I can feel his greatness, you know? Meditation, you know, that's the step 11 tie-in in what we just did. There can be a quiet place where I keep trying to go and ask God to just show himself to me because I know he's love. I know that's what he is. And my soul needs that nourishment. And so you can walk around this life. So, you know, it talks about even in here in step 11 saying we wouldn't think about not nourishing our body. You know, and then this, the meditation, the soul needs this to go on. So I've come to see how significant meditation is. I am a practical sort. So this has taken me a long time to understand the practicality of meditation and nourishing the soul. That, you know, and step two talks about that quantity versus quality of faith. I can have a quantity. I want quality now. I'm done with just quantity. I need quantity too. But I want quality, and my step two is where I'm going to find it, because that's where God is, that greatness. Right now, I'm just learning contemplative prayer, which is a meditation. It's just a quiet meditation. When I have trouble with step two, that's when I come back to my act as if. That's when I come back to I just need to act as if he's that much bigger than me, and there's something that much bigger guiding me. Because I can get into this little tiny self of mine, and I can disconnect with the greatness that's out there. And when I can't bridge that gap, when I'm too stressed or, you know, something's got me, you know, that helps me, just acting as if. And willingness, just look, being willing to see somebody else's program, somebody else's spirituality, somebody else's connection. If I'm just willing to go there, I can retain that sense of God is bigger than me, and he's there. So my program, it says in here that the effectiveness in my 12 and 12, the effectiveness of the whole AA program will rest on how well and earnestly we have tried to come to a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God. So I guess I'm at a point in my program that I want to find that God the lover to turn my life over to. That's who I'm looking for, God the lover, because that's who I want to submit to instead of this white knuckle submission sometimes. Generally in my head I'm going to want to either, you know, I like to persecute myself and get into the guilt and everything that I'm doing that's wrong. Or I want to rescue from that. And I want to find something that's going to rescue. Maybe I'll go just do emails on computer. There used to be food that would save me. Maybe I want to do emails on computer. I don't know. Maybe I want to do something else. But, you know, I will try to rescue myself from that persecution. Or I'll just plumb drop on the ground and be in a victim state. Then I'll just stay stagnant. I'm just going to, you know, I'm just a victim. So, you know, I have to learn, my step three's got to guide me away from the stinking thinking and all that garbage in my head. Step three's got to keep me that each of my moments, God has something bigger, beautiful, and wonderful that's right now. It's right now. You know, when I go back there in the past and I go there in the future, or I can't handle the present, I've got to go back to the fact there's something bigger driving and I've got to latch into it. I've got to. Or I stay stuck. It talks about reliance and not defiance. Well, again, if God is this lover who wants only what's best and wonderful for me and to help me serve others, why would I defy that? Why would I ever defy that if I have a sense of that? So I'm back to step two for my step three. I still need to be willing to do step three even when that feeling isn't there. I've got to draw on at the other places. But it's for me ever going back to that sense of greatness and trust. Instinct and logic seek to bolster my egoism. Well, I really have had to contemplate, what is egoism? Well, they talk about all those instincts. And for me, it's my perfectionism, who I think I'm supposed to be, and the guilt that comes with that, because I think I'm supposed to be something or somebody, or I want something, I want a certain convenience. You know, I don't want the big things. I don't want to win the lottery. I don't want to be filthy rich. I don't want to be famous. I want convenience. I want comfort. I want things to go my way a little bit more than they do. I want my kids to be easier than they are. I want my husband to, I don't know, be more talkative. But really, would he have married me if he were? I don't leave a lot of room for him. So, you know, these are all the things that my egoism speaks to me. And really, for me, the most detrimental is the perfectionism. And boy, can I pervert the message of program into being a bat to tell me how I'm supposed to be. But, you know, getting to step 10, and step 10 is a balance sheet. There's two sides of it. The side that I was the little worm who didn't do so great, but thank God there's someone so much bigger that's going to help me get back on the right track. And then there's the other side. Well, I can use that to bolster my egoism too, can't I? Where I've done well, but really that's not what it's about. For me, it's about kind of getting that image of me, I'm laying on a raft in that river. You know what I'm saying? I was just brought downstream easily at that moment, that nice part of my balance sheet where I did the right thing. I don't want to pervert program into boosting my ego any more than I want it, you know, to feed my ego. And I need to do, if I'm doing this right and this right and this right, it's all the same instinct and ego stuff. I don't want to pervert program to be that. So my instinct and logic will bolster my egoism, and I will even use program to do that if I'm not careful, if I don't keep resting in who God really is and what He really is looking for in me. And that's just moment by moment trusting in what's best for me and everybody else anyway. So that trust comes back again. Intelligence, backed by my willpower, can rightly control our inner lives. That has been the biggest lie that I have experienced. I thought that I would go based on what I engineered. You know, it's kind of like that river's flowing. Well, I want to be the Army Corps engineer and come in, and I want to make all the tributaries, and I want to divert it, and I want to do all sorts of things to the river. But that's the blessing, actually really the blessing of this disease, because it also talks about, I'm trying to remember, it was in step three, I believe. Everywhere around we see people's self-sufficiency, and it talks about how we can see how it's failing. Well, you know what? I was blessed to have hit that awful, painful bottom, that I was able to get the smack upside the head that said self-sufficiency doesn't work. Because that can sound good up here, but until I'm whacked, I don't get it down here. And I got that. And that's the blessing. There's grace in the horrible fall I had to take. There was tremendous grace. When I look around, I see people still living on self-sufficiency. I can see the grace. It's not easy to live this every day. It's just not easy. However, I feel grateful. My inventory. I read, this is something that's very interesting, the seven deadly sins. I read that actually they had taken two out, vanity and self-pity. self-pity with my tendency toward depression would have been a good one for me to have, you know, kept in mind. So that kind of helped me that one of the seven deadly sins is self-pity, because that's the reverse pride we talk about in here. So it was helpful for me to read that and see that. So I used the seven deadly sins to look at my defects on a regular basis, and I include self-pity in there, which really can help me. And I also do use my resentment. I believe God has me in relationships so they can be a mirror for me, so I can see myself. Because if I'm really impatient and I live by myself, it's going to, you know, where I have no one around me. I don't have to just live by myself. I just don't have anyone around me. My impatience can just go on and on and on. So I see my relationships and how all the emotions that can come in and the resentments can ultimately mirror back to me what's wrong, what needs to grow in me. And so I like to use the big book, the fourth step, and looking when I have a resentment, what's been triggered in me. Usually for me it's some form of security that hasn't been met. That's my biggie, security. I had an interesting opportunity to do fourth step on something different. The crisis that I went through 18 months ago, I really was the victim of someone else. It really didn't have a whole lot to do with me, so not really anything to do with me. So I had to do my fourth step on simply, you know, this resentment that I really didn't have a part in, and I had to really had to look for a part. You had to, because you can't, you know, what am I going to do? Live in victim status? That will be the death of me. So what I found was that I didn't want to have to do the work of forgiveness. I resented being put in a position that I had to do the work of forgiveness. The work of forgiveness is for everyone. If we were born on this earth, it's for everybody. So in a sense, there was a pride. I don't want to have, and it's work. It's work for forgiveness. It's a continual prayer to come back to compassion for another person and to see yourself as one of the heap of people that have been hurt in this world. And there are people who have been hurt far more severely than I have. And to see yourself as one of the heap that needs to forgive. And so that has helped me. Now, for everything else where I had a part in it, that has actually made it easier in everything else, because working on that level and having to work toward that level of forgiveness and compassion has helped me in everything else. So again, that crisis has borne incredible fruit, but I had to look that even when I didn't have a part, my part was still there. I was mad that I had to work at forgiveness. I'd been put in that position. And compassion. Oh, but ultimately, that pain, as they say, is the admission price to a better life. Because what it called me to do is I had to reach to God for the perfection. You know, I'm such a perfectionist, but how much do I go to God where there's really perfection? Think about that. Do I really want perfection? Or do I just really want to be who I want Jill to be? Because if I really wanted perfection, God's perfection. And that's where I'd always be going. But I don't. So this crisis, what it brought for me, it brought me such terrible pain. I mean, I can't even tell you. So I had to find everything I could to go back to God. I had to get perfection and love. Not found in humans, and I had to get that. I knew that up here, but I had never suffered that level of hurt from humans. So that crisis brought it down here. There was no avoiding it at every cell in my level. Humans can be absolutely destructively harmful. You know, like I've never read about wars and crime and everything else. Well, let it right down here. So that brought me the admission price to seeking a stronger relationship to God was being failed severely by humans. And that has propelled me to needing God on a whole different level and really seeking perfection. I have to tell you that was also felt like a death. It was a death that reached me forward to God. There was a death there for me. So my step five, I come out of hiding when I do step five. I come out of hiding. You know, it's a disease of loneliness where I hide. I'm ashamed. I'm guilty. I'm afraid. I hide. And coming out and telling another person the things that go on in my heart and my mind and the things that I do, it's just a physiological fact that it produces a sense of freedom. You know, I can't re-engineer the way the automobile was made. It's just, I was a machine. I was made a certain way. Physiologically, giving it to another person gives a freedom. It just does. So I use my step five, you know, I guess step 10 is really my daily inventory, but I'm always giving it over. And I love where it says in the 12 and 12, I can justify, or people can justify the most errant nonsense on the ground because God had told them. So I keep that, you know, I want to come back in and do it alone. And so I have to reach back out and do it out here. And it's a death. It's a death of the part of me that wants to just be internal. I've got to reach out to a different way. I can't hide. It's painful. But step five brings freedom. Step six, getting ready. You know, I have this death imagery that you can tell, this death imagery of my ego dying, this my convenience, my security, my comfort, how I think it should be, what I think, what people think of me, how I should look, what I'm supposed to be. So I love step six because it prepares me for death. You know what I'm saying? I see six as a preparing for death because in step seven I'm giving away my defects, all those coping mechanisms, all those things to keep the little, small, defective me functioning so poorly. I've got to let go of that stuff and give it to God. So step six for me is preparing for my death in a way, a very necessary death. My ways of coping and protecting myself. A readiness for surrender. I mean, I imagine physically at the end of my life it's going to be something of the same, you know? So this is my little program hospice, my step six, that I keep just asking God to take it. I had this little microcosm. I hate roller coasters and I'm terrified of them. I always was as a kid, but now I got kids and I want to have connection with them and I want them to know that I love them. And my 8-year-old, after going on this wooden roller coaster that beats the body up like nobody's business, after going on my husband 4 times, had to show mommy this great wooden roller coaster. I have to tell you that the death of my fear, because I didn't want to go on it. I already got on another one. I mean, I can't even tell you. So, but my kid asking me to go on, I'll go on. So I went on with him, and I came out and it was freedom. You know what I'm saying? It was like, it was just a little microcosm of what I do in 6 and 7. It was that death and that surrender and the freedom. For me, step 7 is, it's about my humility. And something that always gets me and tells me how far I have to go, it asks, you know, did I humbly ask whether my instincts were being met or not? Did I humbly ask for my defects to be lifted, whether or not my instincts were being met? Oh, did I ask to just do it? I mean, my motives, you know, whether or not that's stuff that can only come from the supernatural power. I don't have that in me, so. I'll try to go through. I don't know how long I have, but I don't want to spend my 5. Okay, we'll see. We'll do the last 5 steps quick. Okay, so I was always fleeing from pain and problems and not wanting to deal with suffering, and there's got to be a learned tolerance for this process of dying to myself. It's a process. I'm always trying to go into the room where there's God and truth, and I'm over here in the self, and I've got to continually be willing to kind of let it go and die to it so I can go over here and experience truth. I don't even find it as some ladder I go up. I feel like I jump rooms all the time. You know, I go back and forth, but that's just going to be my process. Somebody said, surrender isn't an ego possession that I get to have and keep. It's a process. It's this process of going back to God and coming back to me and my selfishness. Steps, my apologizing to people and making my amends is not always easy. One time I was really rude to somebody on the phone at a store because he really ticked me off. I had to call back the store and ask for him and apologize. That's like worse than apologizing to my family. But I actually did it because I got really annoyed. And I didn't yell at him or anything, but I was really tense, and he knew I was mad at him. So it's about willingness. And my balance sheet in step 10, like I said, I've got my imperfections. My imperfections, I've learned, have to be a part of the journey of perfectionism, in God's perfectionism, where it says that the perfect objective of God, I have to find a way to fold in my imperfections if I'm going to survive this journey. If I can't fold in my failings and my imperfections on this journey, I can't make it. I can't, because I'm going to always go back to protecting myself and who I'm supposed to be and what people are going to think of me. If I can't fold them in and come to it, and what's acceptance for me? I used to see it as this thing that had this victim hue to it. You know, I had to accept. You know, it sounded like a sentence, some type of criminal sentence. I had to accept. What I've learned for me is acceptance is just, you know, this is God's reality, and asking what I can learn from it instead of how fast I can run from it. So I'm working toward the acceptance of my imperfections and not running from them and letting them fold into the pattern, and the right side of the balance sheet where I'm all the positive things I've done, just see myself as just cruising down God's river and he carried me. It doesn't have to booster I'm so great and affirm my ego or anything else. It's just I was cared for and I surrendered at that moment. Step 11 tells me the world's libraries and places of worship are a treasure trove for all seekers, and I must keep searching. I cannot stop. This is my foundation, but it does not stop. I keep going. And the crisis that I had 18 years ago, I was in, Eastern philosophies, Western philosophies, Catholicism, Buddhism, Hinduism. I went everywhere. It just didn't matter. And I found beautiful stuff when I found it's all truth. That whatever garbage I see in people, whatever underlies their faith, is beautiful. The major faiths are beautiful. So I keep searching for that truth. And it is, step 11 is the way I can remain in my belief that God's greater than me. And just quickly, step 12, for me, the difficulty in dealing with others is just a constant looking toward God for every step of the way, because my perceptions are so far off. It can't be about what they want or what they think. It can't be about what I want or what I think. It's just, I almost have to get a tunnel vision of God guiding me, just taking in information. When my ego gets involved, I get angry that someone acts like that. I get impatient because it shouldn't be that way. Or I get offended that someone acts. When my ego's not involved, I can actually let someone know that it wasn't okay how they acted without being offensive. When all of that, what I want is out of it, I can approach another person and be one with fellows in a way that doesn't threaten or harm. And I don't get impatient or angry. They can be the way they are, and I can say what I need to say. So I need to go to a place of prayer to work my step 12 well with other people and really practicing these principles in all my affairs. And so, I'm sure I'm about done now. Am I about done?
No.
Okay. So, what I have found is in the 12 steps is that myself as a machine is made for connection to God and to other people, and that these steps keep me from getting hooked into me and tight me and keep that connection. It shows me how to do it, and I was just made to do that. I can't put, you know, water in my van and expect it to run, and put gasoline in my cup to use all day for the fuel for my body to hydrate me. It doesn't work. The 12 steps shows me how the machine works, and humility is what allows me to use the 12 steps to let the machine run emotionally, spiritually, physically, how it's meant to run. Thank you.
Thanks so much. We still have a couple of questions after the speaker, and if you would just repeat the question for the
absolutely microphone. Sure. Any questions?
Well, I have one. How do you keep it fresh day after day?
Keeping it fresh is because I can see when the little me, the part that's full of defects, when I'm looking continually at my inventory and the failings, actually is what keeps it fresh for me. The bigger crises will really keep it fresh for me because it keeps me reaching for God. Whatever keeps me reaching for God keeps it fresh for me.
Do you sponsor, and how do you sponsor?
Yes, I sponsor. I sponsor one person by phone, one person by email. And when I sponsor, it's about having a food plan. For me, I can only sponsor what works for me. My sponsees don't eat exactly how I eat by any stretch. They have things in their food plan I don't. I have things they don't. But there is a structure. There is a daily commitment of food. There is no sugar. Basically, it's a set process. Probably more daily step process than the big inventories and step fives, but it's a daily applying the steps to a daily life, probably more than anything in practice right now. But of course, the big fours and fives are, you know, always there to come. So.
Thanks. Anybody else? All right. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.